Hello, I'm Trey Marone, and welcome to the West Virginia Educast. You know, the number of students in school districts with severe behavior problems seems to be on the increase. Every day, school employees observe how those behaviors can interfere with the students' learning and even the learning of other students. School employees report having to spend more and more of their time addressing the needs of students with behavior problems, which inevitably takes time and attention away from other students. We know that public schools have an obligation to educate all students in the school system, regardless of the students' behaviors. So in order to do so, school districts must work to help these children change their disruptive and dangerous behaviors into conduct that is appropriate for the school environment. That is no small task. Joining us today to discuss this very issue is Dr. Shelby Haynes, board-certified behavior analyst, school psychologist, former special education director for Marshall County Schools, and the current superintendent of Marshall County Schools. Dr. Haynes has taught in both general and special education classrooms and has worked as a school psychologist in an alternative education program. She has worked with students with learning disabilities, autism, and behavior disorders in public schools, private schools, hospital-based programs, and also as an independent consultant. Welcome, Dr. Haynes.
Thanks for having me, Trey.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Dr. Haynes, you know, educators routinely remark that there are more students with serious behavior problems now than there were, say, 10 or 15 years ago. In your experience, are West Virginia schools actually seeing an increase in the number of students with severe behavior problems? And if so, are there any clear reasons or causes for this that you've seen?
We see this very clearly in Marshall County Schools, and I feel confident in saying that all of the counties in the Northern Panhandle see this same rise in numbers. One apparent reason is because of neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Well, what is that, neonatal abstinence syndrome?
You'll hear people talk about NAS, neonatal abstinence syndrome. And essentially, that means that a child is born withdrawing to some substance in which they were exposed in the womb. So for example, in 2007, there were about 7 NAS births per 1,000 in West Virginia. In 2017, this number jumped to about 50 per 1,000 births in West Virginia. That's 5% of all births. So those kids are now entering our school system. There's also been significant improvements in the area of special education that have supported this increase, in my opinion. As recent as 20 years ago, many of these students were not served to the extent they are now. Oftentimes, students were not offered the free and appropriate public education that we offer today. We call this FAPE. FAPE is part of an appropriate service, but there's also a component called search and serve. So not only do we provide services to the students, but we also need to find these students who might need assistance and give them their supports. So I think when we start talking about FAPE, we also have to think about the assessment part. To find these kids, we assess these kids, and we have much more detailed means of assessing students than we've ever had before. So for example, 20 years ago, when we would have a student referred to us who possibly was on the autism spectrum, there was a quick little screener or questionnaire that they were given. And now we have very in-depth assessments for autism. That's just one example.
Okay. So, well, from what I'm hearing, you've identified several reasons that we might conclude that we are seeing an increase in students with behavior disorders in the school systems, NAS, the neonatal abstinence syndrome, the search and serve, which is something that now is I guess, used more often, or maybe it's new and newly developed, but it helps identify students in need. Thereby, you're going to increase the number of students that are getting served because the problems have been identified that maybe before were overlooked. And better assessment tools, it helps as well, it sounds like. So once the students who are, you know, experiencing these behavior disorders and it's impacting their educational system, do schools have a responsibility to help them overcome those behavior problems? And if so, how does that work in practice?
Schools absolutely have a responsibility to serve these students. We've already spoken about FAPE, but now what we have to do that we have found, we've evaluated these students, we have to determine what that appropriate education is for those students so that they are best served. We need to remember that students with disabilities are first and foremost general education students. So a lot of times people think special education is a place. Special education isn't a place, it's a service, it's a support system. So when you start looking at special education law, there's something called least restrictive environment. You'll hear people say LRE, that the student should be working through. So many students start out in general education and they require pull-out support or some behavior modification strategies. You'll hear people say things like they're on a check-in, check-out program or a behavior tracking form, things like that. There are thousands of strategies to employ to make students successful in the least restrictive environment possible. So the students are in general education to the greatest extent possible, and we get more and more restrictive.
Does least restrictive environment mean that all students have to be in general education?
Absolutely not. Some students require intensive special education services and are served in the special education environment or at home or even in a residential facility. We just need to find out what services the kid needs and serve them to the best of our ability in the most appropriate placement.
So if you're going to restrict the environment of the student, then that needs to be identified as the only way you're going to be able to serve that student or meet their needs is in a more restrictive environment, because the goal is to have the least restrictive environment. Is that right?
That is correct. That's okay. Correct, Trey.
All right. So, you know, I've heard some say that behavior is really just a form of communication. If so, and if you agree or you've heard that as well, what do you believe students are trying to communicate when they engage in these severe behaviors on a, you know, regular basis?
Well, Trey, that's the million-dollar question. If we know what the function of the child's behavior is, we can quickly design and implement a plan to give the child a more socially acceptable behavior to get whatever they need. So think about a crying baby. When a baby starts to cry, as a parent, you begin to determine the function of that child's behavior. Do they want to be held? Do they need a diaper change? Are they hungry? And you start implementing strategies until this behavior of crying stops. You know, as a parent of a toddler, you look at your toddler and you say, use your words, because this is a more socially acceptable way for your toddler to get their needs met instead of just crying. We do this in school every day. When a child is calling out in class, we sit and think to ourselves, are they avoiding task completion? Are they trying to get attention? What is the function of their behavior? And when a child is screaming and hitting, what are they trying to tell us by doing that behavior? Then we try to figure out why and replace it with a more acceptable behavior.
Well, that's a great analogy. You know, I have three children. Mine are all in their 20s now, but I can remember they were all different. Can remember my oldest, she was, I guess, what people refer to as a little bit colicky. And I knew that when I heard that cry or knew what the circumstances were, I knew what it was. And I would stand up. I don't know what that is about colic, but I would stand up in the living room, rocking back and forth while I held her. And I just watched TV while I did it. And it was fine. But if I'd sat down, I mean, you know, all of a sudden she'd be upset again. So I think we all do as parents, we recognize that and we realize that our students, when they act out, whether it's crying when they're babies or they do things that are you know, considered to be inappropriate behaviors or disruptive behaviors in the school system, to identify and understand what the reason is behind that. And you said, you know, that's the million-dollar question, and that's such a great analogy. So do school districts then need to tailor all behavior programs on a one-by-one basis for each individual student? Because that seems like that could be pretty time-consuming.
We could never have an individual behavior program for every single student in our school. So we actually employ something called MTSS, multi-tiered system of support. This is just what it says. It's a tiered system of support. And in tier one, we're looking at teaching the students, all of the students, all of the appropriate behaviors that they need to exhibit in school. We teach them all of the rules, the expectations. We go around the school and we teach them how you're supposed to act in a bathroom, how you're supposed to act at the cafeteria and the assemblies, what is acceptable and what is not acceptable behavior. So if we implement this tier one program with fidelity, this should meet the needs of the majority of our students. So then many of these programs are three tiers. And so when we move to a smaller group of students into tier two, these are the kids who maybe weren't as successful. They need a little reteach session. This would be about 15% of the students. And in that little 15% of the students in your school who are now in tier two, they are given another teaching lesson. They're given reminders. They're given notes home. Just a little bump to get them over the edge. Now, if they're still not successful, we go to the peak of the triangle for our tier three students, and that's about 5% of your student population in your school. And these kids receive the most intensive intervention. They may have a formal behavior intervention plan where a team of people work together to do that individual plan like you were talking about. And these kids have a lot of behavior tracking, reinforcement schedules, reteach, and they have more of a team looking at their individual plans.
Well, you know what I love about that is really it's the way that you describe that tells us that really all students in the school district need to recognize the need to act appropriately and to have good behavior. And you may be able to do that with a district-wide or even a school-wide set of, you know, rules or guidelines or whatever that you put in place. And the vast majority of your population will respond favorably to that, and it won't interfere with the educational process. And then you just kind of take it up the chart. And then the next tier is a little bit more help and support when you identify the students that need that. And some that's enough for them. And then you get to the 5% who really need some of the most intensive things, as you've mentioned, to help them with their behavior issues, and they get the more intense things, such as you mentioned, I think behavior tracking sheets, checking in and checking out, reinforcement schedules. And so there's not a one size fits all. It's not a cookie cutter approach, but it is a plan that is designed, generally speaking, to the MTSS to really meet the needs of all students in a school district. I like that. So we hear the term IEP a lot, you know, when you're thinking of students that have needs that could be on anywhere on the, you know, it could be all kinds of needs. But an IEP being an individualized education program for students, and a lot of students in school districts have those. But if on that IEP, the student's behavior has been determined to be something that interferes with their own learning, and even maybe that of other students, how is the IEP addressed during this process?
So these students' IEP should be made up of a team of persons who are invested in the student being successful. So you're looking at a team of general education teachers, special education teachers, administrators, and the parent. As kids get older, we oftentimes have the child on the IEP team as well. So this team then determines what modifications, interventions, and services that the child needs to be successful. They also start to determine that least restrictive environment in which the child may find success. So this team determines where the child can have their needs met. That doesn't mean that every child has to be in general education all day. It's what's appropriate for the child. This team also looks at the behavior intervention plan for the student. So this plan will outline baseline behavior, where the kid is starting, as well as targeted behaviors and goals. So many behavior intervention plans also contain emergency plans. We were talking about some kids who have some extreme behavior. So if this child gets really aggressive, what do we do? What are the steps? And that would all be outlined very clearly in that IEP and in that behavior intervention plan. The plan goes a little step further to outline the roles of the team members, the frequency of the reinforcement, the strategies that we're going to teach or reteach this student, and how we will collect data, when we will review it, how we will review it, are we going to graph it, and so forth.
Okay. Well, you know, you've talked about these behavior intervention plans, and during the introduction, I mentioned that you are a board-certified behavior analyst, or a BCBA. What is a BCBA, and how does a BCBA fit into the public school setting?
So a BCBA is somebody who studies the science of behavior. So a BCBA attempts to implement education or behavior treatments to improve the human condition. So oftentimes we'll collaborate with the IEP team, we'll determine the data collection methods, intervention strategies, frequencies of reinforcement, and ultimately help decide what the function of the behavior is so that we can modify or improve that behavior to be something more socially acceptable. The BCBA might just discuss with the team members about the child, listen and give ideas. They might assist in collecting data. They might even go in and model strategies for the team, for the teacher, for the parents. The BCBA might also help the team in knowing when they should change their strategy. Should they increase the reinforcement schedule? Should there be a visual support to help this child know what to do? And are they graphing the data? Our ultimate goal is to determine the function of the behavior and help eliminate or replace with the more appropriate behavior.
Excellent. You know, I'm aware of a number of lawsuits and complaints that have been filed to challenge a school district's provision of behavior supports to students with disabilities. So in terms of resources, what would you recommend that a county school district have in place to meet the needs of these students to try to avoid such lawsuits?
One key element that I have found is communication. So you have a team of people and you need to be working with that team and include the team to the greatest extent possible in decision-making, in training, in education. And we really need to wrap ourselves around this child to make the change that's needed. I think it's important to train general education teachers in behavior intervention, as well as service personnel. We have a lot of service personnel who work with these students. I think that the team also should include parents. Sometimes we even train siblings because they're at home with this child in the evening and they need to know the strategies too, when appropriate. Not always, of course. If we are handling a behavior one way at school and then the parent does something completely different at home, they could be countering each other and we need to be in communication and on the same page moving forward. I think it's important to train staff on data collection. I have seen so many times where parents or teachers will spend countless hours writing out anecdotal records when really they could get the same information and it would actually do me more good as a BCBA if they would give me tally marks of how many times the behavior occurred. That way I could graph it and see if it's getting worse, getting better. And so training people on that data collection is important as well.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to simplify this at all, because that was certainly a lot of valuable information. But what one of my takeaways was from that answer was, is one of the best ways to provide education is through education, to educate the employees and maybe the family members. And I think very importantly, you mentioned, you know, that general education teachers who sometimes, you know, feel like, I know they've, every general ed teacher has had some training in special education, but they're not necessarily, you know, carrying a degree or certification in that area. But the importance of everybody that's in that school environment to know and understand how this works is so important. And you mentioned service personnel. And I know a couple of years ago, the legislature even added a class title, I think, that was specifically in the aid category that addressed, it was like a behavior type classification title. So recognizing, again, the importance of employing even service personnel that are prepared to address these behaviors, who have been really doing it for years, but to recognize it, maybe give them a little bit of a pay bump in doing that. So definitely a team effort there in order. I wanted to go back. I don't know why I got that behavior intervention plan. I guess that has the acronym BIP. Is that called a BIP?
We do call it a BIP sometimes.
That's a little bit fun to say, a BIP. Okay. So when these behavior intervention plans are implemented correctly, what kind of changes in student behavior might be expected? With that, how long would you expect it to take for a student's behavior to be modified in order to teach them appropriate behaviors?
Well, there's no magic number on how long it takes to modify a behavior. Many of our children have multiple behaviors that need addressed. So as the IEP team, we have to decide which behaviors are the most detrimental, and those are the ones that we want to target first. We may not be able to address all of the behaviors at once, or we'll fail at all of them. Think about when you have a lot of things going on, and if you try to do everything at once, you don't do any of them very well. So there's some times where we have to look at all of the child's behaviors and pick out the one that we are going to target, or maybe two, as a team, and focus on those. And then once those targeted behaviors have improved, we can move on to other behaviors. And sometimes that's very frustrating because you want this to be fixed quickly, and it doesn't always happen that way. We also have to remember that sometimes things get worse before they get better. Or we might have a little honeymoon period where the child complies and then the behavior gets worse. That happens sometimes when kids are saturated with reinforcement, and then they start to get used to that. So we just need to remember to keep graphing that data, monitoring and collecting that data so that we can see this child's behavior as a number. Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? What do we need to do next? Some people will say, you're just bribing kids with those behavior intervention plans. No, the ultimate goal is to be intrinsically motivated. But oftentimes we need to start out with a tangible reinforcement. I mean, think of human beings. I like my job, but I also like my paycheck. And that's an extrinsic reinforcer or a motivator. And that increases the likelihood of me coming to work and doing a good job. And so sometimes we have to give kids those external reinforcers, and we want to move towards a more intrinsic motivation, like a sense of accomplishment. But sometimes you have to start with something more tangible and then work towards the intrinsic.
Absolutely. That works for all of us. And the other thing I took away from that, your response was that prioritizing is key. I mean, you may have a student that has multiple layers of issues and you can't solve them all at once, and you prioritize those and address those, you know, one at a time. And that's an excellent point as well that picked up there. So is there like a central theme or attitude that schools ought to have about behavior modification programs? And if so, what might that look like?
Well, I always try to remember three things. I think we need to remember that dealing with these behaviors can be physically and mentally exhausting for everybody. And when I say everybody, I even mean the student. It's important that you have to remember we're talking about somebody's child. And we always need to remember that no matter how tired or frustrated we are, this is somebody's child. And if this was my child, how would I want them to be treated? I also think that we need to remember to not take these behaviors personally. The child is trying to communicate something to us. They're not targeting us. They're trying to tell us something. And we need to look at these behaviors as a means of communication. And finally, I think you have to start every day fresh. You can't hold a grudge over something the child said or did the day before. And sometimes that's hard.
Very, very practical pointers and excellent, in my opinion, for what that's worth. I've learned so much during this episode. And Dr. Haynes, I cannot thank you enough for taking your time today to discuss this topic and to give our listeners some very valuable insight and tools for a school district to use to, you know, identify behaviors that might be interfering with the educational process, as well as different types of behavior modification that can be used towards helping every child to be successful in the school system. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
And be sure and join us for another episode of the West Virginia Educast, where we will look at other important issues facing school districts. Also, if you've missed any of our prior episodes, there are now more than 20 recorded episodes on the Bowles Rice website. That's www.bowlesrice.com that are easy to access and listen to at your convenience. Once you're on the website, just type podcast in the search engine at the top right corner and you'll find them. Until then, I'm Trey Marone, and this is the West Virginia Educast. Thanks for taking a listen.